assuming we protect the value of the permanent fund into the future, this will probably be our most robust annual revenue source from here forward.
To protect its future, state officials caution against big spending from the permanent fund. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, will the global jump in oil prices mean anything for Alaska?
If you're looking at the impact on investment and production, you really have to look at more of the long term.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Going without health insurance could be financially devastating. Healthcare bills are the leading cause of personal bankruptcy. Open enrollment for 2018 plans is November 1st through December 15th. A household of four with an annual income of less than $123,000 may qualify for federal tax credits to help cover premium costs. Get signed up for health insurance at healthcare.gov today. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
The Alaska House passed a bill early this morning that revises last year's overhaul of the state's criminal sentencing laws. After a series of contentious votes on amendments, 32 House members voted for Senate Bill 54, while 8 voted against it. Anchorage Democratic Representative Matt Clayman says the bill makes improvements to last year's Senate Bill 91.
I suggest to all of you that Senate Bill 91 has never been the boogeyman. We know that longer and longer sentences are not making Alaska safer.
SB 54 increases penalties for Class C felonies and petty thefts, as well as for those who violate the conditions of their release. Anchorage Republican Chuck Kopp says the bill is part of a criminal justice reform effort that allows people to redeem themselves.
The most beautiful stories that are ever told among humankind are always stories of redemption. The orphan finding a family, the lost being found, the broken life restored, a wounded heart healed. Senate Bill 54 is very aggressive on crime, but it does not shut the door on a man and a woman's life finding a way back.
The House passed 10 amendments to the bill over 3 days of debate, while defeating 25 others. 6 of the passed amendments toughen penalties for some offenses. Some representatives say the amendments didn't go far enough to restore penalties that were in place before the legislature passed SB 91 last year. Wasilla Republican Representative David Eastman, who was one of 6 Matanuska-Susitna Borough Republicans who voted against SB 54.
The message of SB 54 that I see is, can be summed up in 3 words. We as a state love criminals.
2 Democrats, Sam Keto of Juneau and David Guttenberg of Fairbanks, also voted against the bill. They said it repealed too much of SB 91. If the Senate doesn't agree to the changes the House made to the bill, the two chambers could form a conference committee to try to resolve their differences. Alaska state government will have a roughly $600 million gap between how much it spends and how much it raises. And State Budget Director Pat Pitney said today that could hurt the permanent fund in the future. Pitney told the House Finance Committee the legislature will have to enact some combination of tax increases and spending cuts to close the gap, or it will reduce billions of the Alaska permanent fund.
We're looking at a way to provide fiscal certainty, connect the economy to the state services received, get significant fiscal certainty, but we will continue to have the question of reduced spending or increased revenue as we go forward.
Governor Bill Walker has proposed a $320 million tax on income from employment. The tax would be capped at twice the annual Alaska Permanent Fund dividend amount. The state budget projections are based on assumptions that the House and Senate reach a compromise on a plan to draw money from permanent fund earnings and cut dividends. Pitney says even this won't be enough to avoid cutting into the size of the fund if lawmakers can't agree on more changes. Pitney says the permanent fund could be $5 billion smaller in 10 years. She says that would happen if the legislature spends not only a planned draw from fund earnings, but an additional draw to close the annual budget gap. And she says that size reduction in the fund would cut annual interest and investment earnings by $250 million forever. Fund earnings are increasingly important to the state.
Assuming we protect the value of the permanent fund into the future, this will probably be our most robust annual revenue source from here forward.
The tax bill was the original reason why Walker called a special session, but members of the Senate majority have expressed skepticism about the need for the legislation. They say rising oil revenue provides some help to state finances. Global demand for oil is up, and prices have surged to their highest level since 2015. In Alaska, North Slope crude rose to more than $63 a barrel on Monday. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more on how state economists are responding to the jump in prices.
At the Department of Revenue, Chief Economist Dan Stickle says they're pulling together data for the state's annual oil price forecast. It's due out in December. And while they are watching the jump in oil prices, they're not ready to change their long-term forecast just yet.
Short-term price movements, they're interesting, but it's if you're looking at the impact on investment and production, you really have to look at more of the long term.
And in the long term, the state isn't expecting oil prices to rally much higher for much longer. In late October, the department put out a preview of that forecast, and state economists predicted that oil prices will average about $54 per barrel next year. The price of oil is often volatile, especially when global supply and demand don't line up. And in the last few years, Stickle says Alaska has generally been along for the ride when those dramatic shifts happen.
What we've been looking at is just this idea that, you know, we had a few years of an undersupplied market with oil prices up over 100, and then we had a few years of an oversupplied market when prices went down to the 30s and below.
In the last year or so, Stickle says global supply and demand have roughly balanced out. But even when there's more demand than supply, it doesn't typically have an immediate effect on production of Alaska's oil. Stickle says that's because Alaska isn't a swing producer. Oil production projects in the state take a long time to explore and develop and bring online.
And then they produce for a very long time. When a project in Alaska happens, it's a very long-term investment and it's a long-term production.
So when global demand for oil is higher than supply, Alaska's not likely to step in and bring production up quickly to meet that need.
You look at the shale oil down south, and you can make a decision to drill a well, and you can have that well producing a few months later, and a lot of the oil comes right up front.
So for now, Stickle says the state is sticking with its forecast. Adjusting for inflation, they're predicting that oil prices will stabilize in the $55 to $60 per barrel range for the next 5 years. The price increase helps the state's bottom line. But for the budget to be balanced, even with all of the budget cuts that have happened, oil prices would have to be much higher.
You need ANS prices to be up in the $90 per barrel range or higher. And I don't think we're anywhere near going back to those levels. So we still have a hole to fill.
From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating at the Haines Bald Eagle Festival.
This river freezes a lot later than the other ones, so we have a really late run of salmon, and that's what the eagles come for.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Congress recently learned it has the power to overturn the amended Tongass Land Management Plan, a document that was years in the making. A Juneau business owner flew to Washington, D.C. with a message for the Alaska congressional delegation, don't Keegan McCarthy likes the Tongass plan, which was completed in the final weeks of the Obama administration. He operates a small cruise company catering to groups of 12 or fewer. McCarthy says the delegation seems to have an outsized focus on the timber industry, and his mission is to remind them other Tongass-dependent businesses are providing jobs and economic stimulus.
You know, logging timber industry did bring a lot to Southeast Alaska in its heyday. Some good, some bad. But Southeast Alaska has evolved. We've evolved into a great tourism destination. Our commercial fisheries are flourishing. I mean, we have amazing other opportunity in Southeast Alaska right now.
Trout Unlimited sponsored McCarthy's citizen lobbying trip. The Tongass plan they are advocating to keep calls for a transition to young growth timber. Senator Lisa Murkowski is among those who doubt the plan provides enough timber and time to keep what remains of the industry going. Here she is at a hearing last year.
We can't make those trees grow any faster. That's our problem.
Murkowski, Senator Dan Sullivan, and Congressman Don Young have all said they're considering overturning the new Tongass plan using the Congressional Review Act. The CRA gives Congress 60 days to overturn new rules. But that's 60 legislative days starting from when the administration sends a report on the rule to Congress, so the deadline likely won't fall until well into next year. Alaska Forest Association Director Owen Graham says the Tongass logging industry hopes the delegation succeeds in ditching the plan.
Everybody felt pretty doomed in December last year when the Forest Service signed that plan.
Graham says the plan would have killed the timber business. He calls it a lie. But McCarthy, the Juneau cruise operator, says the plan gives an equal opportunity for other businesses to make in the Tongass, too. Opioid overdoses have gotten a lot of attention in Alaska and elsewhere recently, but state epidemiologists released some startling findings today about a different deadly drug. They say methamphetamine-related fatalities have increased fourfold over the last decade. According to the report, a comparison of three-year averages shows an increase from about one methamphetamine-related death per 100,000 people to nearly six per 100,000. There were also increases in meth-related hospitalizations in recent years, among other adverse health effects. And methamphetamine was often not the only drug used by the people who had overdosed. About half of those who died had also used opioids. Dr. Jay Butler, Alaska's chief medical officer, says it is not uncommon for someone getting their opioid fix to also use meth as a pick-me-up.
Balancing the effects of the two is one of the reasons sometimes methamphetamine and opioids are used together. Sometimes this is called a train wreck, sometimes called a speedball. I think what's different more recently is just that the overall rates have seemed to increase.
Butler says in part that seems to be a result of higher supply meeting higher demand. On the supply side, he says there is evidence of more methamphetamine on the black market at cheaper prices. Butler says the problem requires a multi-pronged solution.
We have to have comprehensive approaches to addressing drug use, that just taking molecule-specific approaches and thinking if we focus solely on opioids, we have nothing else to worry about, is really short-sighted. And we need to get into some of the underlying reasons of the supply and demand that drives addiction in our state and in our country.
The report shows the highest rate of methamphetamine-related deaths was among 45 to 54-year-olds, but methamphetamine deaths happened across the state and among a wide demographic range. Raptors and bird enthusiasts alike flock to Haines for the Bald Eagle Festival, where the world's highest concentration of eagles gathers on the Chilkat River. Last year, the bird count spiked, and numbers are even higher this year. KHNS's Barrett Wilbur reports on this year's eagle forecast.
It's eagle season in Haines. Sydney Campbell is the education and outreach coordinator at Haines's American Bald Eagle Foundation.
This time of year is particularly special. The hydrogeology of the Chilkat is really unique. This river freezes a lot later than the other ones, so we have a really late run of salmon, and that's what the eagles come for.
The foundation capitalizes on the birds in its backyard. As the salmon attract eagles, the foundation welcomes visitors for the annual Bald Eagle Festival. Visiting photographers, birders, and scientists give Haines' economy a bump between cruise and ski seasons. But Campbell says the event isn't just aimed at outsiders.
I think the biggest thing this year is that we really want this to be a community event. Almost every event during the festival is going to be free to Haines locals, and we'd really, really like for them to just come in and meet us and talk with us and see what we do.
Opportunities include hearing scientist Rachel Wheat share her PhD research on Chilkat Valley eagles, a film screening with the Talk Chinook Watershed Council, Alaska Native dance and storytelling, and plain old-fashioned eagle watching, which could be particularly good this year. Pam Randles spent a decade doing scientific eagle counts and passed the torch to Chloe Goodson 2 years ago. After years of decline, the women say birds counted on the Chilkat seem to be rising.
We, for the previous 4 years, were getting counts in the 700 to 900 level. So for her to be getting over 1,000 and 1,300, actually almost 1,400, that's a difference.
That's good news for visiting eagle observers. Randles thinks it's good for residents, too.
The eagles directly reflect the salmon run. And salmon, as you probably know, in this area is crucial to the economy.
Randles says eagle counts can also illustrate environmental changes. The Sirkou Delta on the Chilkat attracts eagles because other rivers, other food sources, freeze over sooner. Fewer eagles at the Sirkou could indicate less ice throughout the valley.
If there is more open water and more access to food for the eagles, they're going to take advantage of that instead of being crowded into the Sirkou fan area. So I think it's an indicator of climate change.
While 2 years of elevated eagle numbers don't prove a lasting trend, Randles and Goodson will keep counting. Their data reaches back to the late 80s, and soon they hope to synthesize what 3 decades of eagle populations can illustrate about changes in the Chilkat Valley. For Sydney Campbell and the Foundation, that link between the birds and the environment motivates the festival.
I mean, hands down, one of the most rich and valuable ecosystems left in North America. So our big action item right now, I think, is just teaching people how to respect it and what we can do to make sure it stays as pristine as it currently is.
This year, the festival will run November 6th through 11th. For a schedule of events, visit khns.org. In Haines, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Last month, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which regulates groundfish in Alaska and other federal fisheries, received some shocking news. Pacific cod stocks in the Gulf of Alaska may have declined as much as 70% over the past 2 years. That estimate is preliminary, but it leaves plenty of questions about the future of cod fishing. KBBI's Aaron Bolton explains.
The first question that comes to mind when you hear the number of Pacific cod in the Gulf dropped by about 2/3 is, what happened? Dr. Stephen Barbeau works with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Division and has been trying to answer that question. Barbeau says the issue likely started with warmer water moving into the Gulf in 2014 and sticking around for the next 3 years.
We had what the oceanographers and kind of in the news media have been calling the blob, which was this warm water that was sitting in the Gulf for those 3 years. And it was different than other years in that it went really deep, but it also lasted throughout the winter.
Warmer water temperatures speed up a fish's metabolism, leading them to eat more.
And so what can happen is you can deplete the food source pretty rapidly when the entire ecosystem is ramped up in those warmer temperatures.
With less food around, the size of Pacific cod in the Gulf dropped. NOAA surveys show that cod were the skinniest on record in 2015. But fish didn't just get smaller. Natural mortality rates also skyrocketed for some fairly important age classes of cod. NOAA saw a large influx of cod larvae in 2012, 2013, and 2015, signaling some good fishing seasons over the next 6 years or so. But between warmer water temperatures and the subsequently shrinking food supply, those fish are not showing up, likely accounting for a large portion of the decline. And this is not the first time cod stocks have taken a dive in the Gulf. The fishery saw a substantial decline in the mid-2000s, but Barbeau says this time is different.
The difference between then and now is that we don't see any recruitment coming in. We're hoping 2017 will be good, but we don't have any indication yet. So our surveys for those smaller fish haven't been conducted. They'll be done next year.
Because of that uncertainty, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council has some difficult decisions to make at its meeting in December. The regulatory body made an initial recommendation in October to reduce the total allowable catch in the Gulf by 30%. But Councilmember Buck Lakaitis says the final decision next month could be different.
I think it's just really important that the public understand that that's a preliminary number, but they should also understand that there's a fairly big change coming in the cod resource, and so fishermen, stakeholders, a lot of people will be affected, a lot of industry.
Barbeau's analysis will be reviewed by two advisory bodies prior to the council setting 2018 harvest levels. Fishermen will have a chance to weigh in, but Lakaitis says the council will base its decision on the final analysis.
We don't overrule the science. There won't be any miracles as far as the council doing something other than what the science advisors recommend.
Between the Bering Sea and the Gulf, Pacific cod accounts for Alaska's second largest fishery by volume, bringing in $186 million in 2015. Cod numbers in the Bering Sea are also trending down. Its estimated abundance may have fallen nearly 40%, but the cause of that decline is not directly known. As for the future of cod in the Gulf of Alaska, Barbeau says that depends on recruitment over the next few years. But the Gulf is expected to see the return of La Nina, which could mean cooler waters and better conditions for young fish. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
This year will be the first opening for Tanner Crab the Kodiak Management Area has seen in a few years. KMXD's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Nan Nichols, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Area Management Biologist for the groundfish, shellfish, and dive fisheries, says the last opening was in 2013. He says ADF&G conducts an extensive trawl survey program between Dutch Harbor and Kodiak, focused on tanner crab in the Gulf of Alaska.
This year we did 363 stations. About 200 of those are in Kodiak, so quite a few stations around Kodiak to assess tanner crab abundance. Once we work up those survey results, we compare them to abundance thresholds that are set out in the harvest strategy and regulation, and that gives us guidance as to whether we can proceed with the fishery.
He says abundance levels have now reached the point that the tanner crab fishery can open again, and ADF&G recently set the guideline harvest levels.
We're looking to target 260,000 pounds from the east side section and 140,000 pounds from the southwest section. And those will be the only two sections that are open this year.
He says the fishery opens January 15th. Meanwhile, the Dungeness crab season, which opened in May and June, closed last week.
We had five vessels participating. And it looks like we've wrapped up with about 180,000 pounds of Dungeness across the dock. Harvest in Kodiak is pretty variable over the last 10 years. We've had seasons less than 100,000 pounds, and we've had seasons over a million. So this year's kind of right in there, but sort of in the lower portion of what we've seen in the last decade.
Nichols says some of the decrease in participation could be due to this year's good salmon season. He says fishermen may have not felt such a need to turn to Dungeness to supplement their incomes. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Sea Alaska is increasing its investments in Seattle's seafood processing industry. It's part of the Southeast Alaska Regional Native Corporation's effort to boost revenues and increase dividends. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Sea Alaska's first investment in the industry came in 2016. It bought a minority interest in Independent Packers Corporation, a Seattle processor employing about 180 people. It next purchased a majority stake in Odyssey Enterprises. It's also in Seattle and has about 200 workers. Both do secondary processing, also called value-added. That means they turn seafood into soups, stews, breaded, and similar products to sell under their own names or someone else's. The new addition is Orca Bay, based in Renton, about 10 miles southeast of Seattle. It makes similar products and has about as many workers.
The products they have, their customer base, their marketing strategies, their access to resource, all is very complementary.
Anthony Millott is president and CEO of Sea Alaska, which has about 23,000 shareholders, mostly Tlingits or Haidas. He says Orca Bay is in the process of merging with Odyssey.
The combination of the two offers, you know, not only good scale, but an opportunity to, you know, have an expanded customer base and give us a platform where we can continue to build our marketing expertise, try innovative new products, and be the beginning of the seafood platform that we envisioned.
He says it's Sea Alaska's last processing investment for now, but the corporation also plans to purchase Alaska Seafood for the plants. Sea Alaska's seafood buys are part of a five-year recovery plan after its construction company lost more than $25 million and other businesses more than doubled that amount. Among other things, the plan called for development of businesses closer to Southeast Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, where many shareholders live. Earlier investments included plastics factories as far away as Alabama and Guadalajara, Mexico. Millott says processing is one reason the corporation has been able to boost its part of this month's $11 million shareholder distribution.
The earnings have improved across the board. Natural resources, government services, and the new seafood investments are all adding to the earnings that are culminating in this increased dividend.
The dollar per share contribution isn't a lot, but it's the largest in the past few years. Earnings from Sea Alaska's Marjorie Young Permanent Fund added another 86 cents per share. But the largest part of the dividends comes from natural resource earnings shared by all 12 regional native corporations. That amount, $4.10 per share, is down. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Casey Grove in Anchorage, Barrett Wilbur in Haines, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations, GCI is your partner in possibilities. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.